Today we talk to someone who will be familiar to the Another Europe family, former national organiser Michael Chesham, who has a book out on the making of a new left.
Hi, I'm Michael, and I'm taking a year out of my history degree to be the Education and Campaigns Officer at UCL.
Brexit now is really a Tory project, and we are only going to get a Tory outcome to this. It's dripping with imperial nostalgia. It's about legitimising anti-migrant narratives.
Why is this protest started?
This protest happening is in order to derail the Higher Education White Paper. It was released this summer. It is, in essence, an attempt to privatise higher education in Britain, and it comes in the wake of the worst peacetime generational betrayal in modern British history.
Hi, and welcome to another Europe is Possible podcast with me, Zoe Williams, and Luke Cooper. We're going back to ground zero for AEIP today to interview Michael Chesham, who founded the whole thing with Luke, to discuss Michael's book, This Is Only the Beginning, The Making of a New Left, From Anti-Austerity to the Fall of Corbyn. I cannot stress enough how much you should read it. It's really good. And it's the first thing that's put me in a good mood about politics for years. So the central assertion, as you'll guess from the title, is that the left's resurgence is not over. Just because the Corbyn project failed doesn't mean the ideas that belied it have lost their currency. I will drill into the optimism of that eventually. But first, Michael, can you give some recollections of the student movement of 2010? And why do you pinpoint those rather than Corbyn's leadership 5 years later as the crucible of left revival?
The student revolt of 2010 is the subject of a lot of mythology, and there'll be a certain proportion of people listening to this podcast who, when I start to talk about Milbank, and I'll talk about that in a second, will sort of groan and go, oh, not this again. But nonetheless, I think it was a very important moment, and I think it was an important moment for two reasons. One, well, I suppose at a very basic level, by the time that Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader of the Labour Party, the radicalisation that got him there had already happened by definition. And the student movement was the beginning of two connected but distinct processes. And one, probably the main one in terms of the development of Corbynism, is its acceleration of the wider anti-austerity movement. So the student movement begins in 2010, in November of that year, with a protest organised by the NUS and the UCU, the Lecturers' Union, that ends extremely with this huge spectacle of Conservative Party headquarters being smashed in at number 30 Milbank. And from there, we get a range of big days of action. So 24th of November, you see, was probably the biggest student mobilisation in British history, about 120,000 students on the streets. On the 30th of November, another day of action, much colder weather, slightly lower turnout, but nonetheless, a lot of disruption all over the country. And the 9th of December, where the parliamentary vote happens and you get this kind of Battle of Parliament Square moment. The long and the short of that is that by the end of the following year, by the end of 2011, what began as a movement of hundreds of thousands had broadened out and accelerated the development of a movement that contained millions of people. That movement, 2 million people on strike by November 2011, got Occupy tents being pitched all over the country. You've got massive demonstrations taking over central London, police fully losing control of the city for a bit. You've got local anti-cuts groups springing up all over the country that coordinate things. All of these things on their own would have been big moments. Taken together, that moment of 2010 and 2011 put together was a moment of really mass radicalisation. The other reasons why I think that the student movement of 2010 are important is because of the themes that it kind of displays. It was a revolt at the end of history. I think it's very important to say just how dead the British left was at this time. We'd just gone through a huge financial crisis where capitalism, particularly neoliberal and free market capitalism, had been found politically, economically and morally bankrupt. And yet this austerity consensus reigned. The political left, these weirdos like John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn, these outcasts, were nowhere near the political mainstream. And a generation, I mean, you have to think at the time, young people were renowned for their political apathy. I mean, that just sounds mad.
It does sound really mad, because I remember all our conversations for the whole of the noughties were, why don't young people care?
Yeah, absolutely. And here you have this explosive revolt, and it was very tactically very radical. You know, it was involved breaking glass, it involved occupying buildings, and it was a really important moment in the development of what later being called Generation Left, this explosive moment of generational consciousness. And I think it was the beginning of a moment where class politics came back into British political discourse.
Luke, presumably you're involved too. Is this where you two met? I'm not trying to run this like Oprah, by the way.
So I was wondering when we thinking about, I'm not sure exactly when we met, but yes, before the national campaign against fees and cuts, there was something called the National Convention Against Fees and Cuts. So at least then and sometime before that at UCL. I mean, what I like about the book is, as apart from it being exceptionally well written, it's a beautiful read. And obviously all listeners should go out and buy it. But what I really like about it is it makes one think that I've been on this fantastically exciting journey. And in a way, it does capture something about why people in that moment of 2010 felt the need to set out and change the world, how they committed to it with a great deal of energy. They really had big visions. They fought the status quo. And they wanted to be part of like something that was bigger than themselves. So you get this feeling from the book that there's this drama of the historical journey. And you also get the feeling, which it was a lot of fun along the way. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who feel that way, who were part of this journey and who were on it. Now, the danger, and you mentioned this already, Michael, so I think it's worth probing, is that it can lead to a kind of left nostalgia for what was in the end a decade of glorious defeat. However exciting it was, in the end the left wasn't able to set out and achieve what the Milbank generation sought to achieve. And I would push back slightly on what you both said about the noughties. I mean, I'm a little bit older than Michael, so I've been through at least two different waves of left nostalgia. I'm 38. I first got involved in lefty politics in the anti-war and anti-capitalist movements of the early 2000s, and they're mentioned in the book too. They were also very exciting, but I guess unlike the movements following the 2008 financial crisis, they didn't really have, except maybe Latin America, the Pink Wave, and Italy in Europe, but apart from those cases, they didn't really have any impact on mainstream politics. And in Italy in particular, it ended pretty disastrously for the left. But I think that rather than saying there was nothing before Milbank, I would say that it's probably similar to now, in the sense that these are sort of ebbs and flows of movement activism. And yes, in the second half of the noughties, there was much less going on than in the first half. But in the first half of the noughties, millions of people marched against the Iraq war and all of this. So there's a hell of a lot going on then too.
But I felt very much about the Iraq war that it just seemed like kind of performative uselessness. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, because I remember, I've got a really long memory for left defeats. I remember being defeated at Greenham and we kind of won. I just really felt that million strong march against Iraq. Anybody who was kind of new to the left via Stop the War or just via wanting to stop the war, that really thought this is such an amazing moment. How can nothing come of this moment? Whereas anybody who was not new to the left was like, well, this isn't going to do anything, but at least we've shown we care, you know? And there is, and not just in the strategy and in the boldness of the student protests, but also in the sense, something about the fact that they weren't kind of pre-defeated by their own memories. The participants just seemed to be kind of a different order of magnitude.
I think that's true. And I don't disagree with what Luke says about, and obviously it didn't come out of nowhere, this revolt. There is actually a very direct connection for a lot of us who took part in 2010 between the Iraq War movement and the student movements of 2010. And in fact, for all of us, when I was 14 when the Iraq War happened, and I spent 2 weeks on the streets of Edinburgh, you know, blocking roads and so on, and I went on the one or two million, we're supposed to say, the huge march in London. But for all of us inside the student movement of 2010, there was a very deliberate attempt to move away from that kind of passive mode of dissent, the kind of usual march from A to B, listen to some nice speeches and go home. This was a disruptive, rebellious moment that aimed to resist rather than protest, is the way that we always used to put it. I also think that what you're saying about people's imaginations in 2010 is a very salient point. The way I talk about it in the book is this generation without a history. What you've got is this generation of young people who actually, well, okay, there were some organised socialists in that movement. This is a moment when actually a vast, vast majority of these young people, students, but also actually a lot of school students as well, aren't connected to traditions. They're separated essentially by the legacy of Thatcherism. You know, 30 years of defeat for the left before 2010 means that all of these, this generation is waking up into essentially, in organisational terms, a bit of a desert on the left. Okay, there wasn't nothing, but actually there wasn't very much for them to wake up into. You know, it wasn't like they were, you know, in 68 or in the 80s, in other moments where young people became active in politics and had a bit of a, you know, took part in a revolt, they would have found themselves with a big organised left around them. We didn't have that. And so because of the legacy of Thatcherism and Blairism, because of the historic weakness of the left, what you get is this generation who are cut off in the moment of their creation from both the good things about organisation, you know, kind of having a broader strategy and a deeper politics, but actually cut off from some of the bad bits as well. The moment of, you know, the occupation of Millbank Tower is a moment of collective imagination as much as it is anything else. And it's a moment of collective imagination that is not born out of knowledge of the past or a sense of historical precedent, but actually a total divorce from historical precedent.
Someone who's quoted a few times saying interesting things is a mutual friend of ours, John Moses. And one of the things that relates to this point about inexperience is that he makes this very interesting point about the kind of faddish quality of the left, and it becomes something of a theme of the book. So whether you refer to it as like this faddish quality, what he means is that there emerge certain, or what he describes is like certain zeitgeists that then are kind of taken up by a kind of swarm of people without maybe that much interrogation. And it links to another theme of the book another way of talking about the same thing as a kind of radical pragmatism. You go into initiative X and then you swarm into campaign Y and then you swarm out again. And in some ways, these are moves between different kind of intellectual political fashions. But it's also a lot better than being dogmatic. And that seems to me something that's been quite positive, that the book brings across well, that this Milbank generation were quite undogmatic, open-minded, and yeah, maybe a bit faddish when it comes to what was in fashion at the time and moves out of fashion. And you link that very well to the rise of Corbynism too.
Yeah, certainly not dogmatic. The last thing you could accuse this generation of being was dogmatic. You know, so you've got people come into the explosion, you know, very many of them have just voted Lib Dem. A lot of the people on those protests just voted Lib Dem. They queued up to vote Lib Dem. All of a sudden, they're taking part in protests that are kind of rioting around the edges. They are being charged by police sources. They're developing a very anti-statist politics. They are surrounded by shit left-wing institutions. I mean, you know, you've got the NUS that condemns protesters. You've got Ed Miliband, who supports austerity. You've got eventually some of the trade union leaderships in particular Unison, that cave, and it's their caving that really kills the anti-austerity movement to a great extent in early 2012. But so there develops a very sort of anarchist-y politics, libertarian communist politics, anarchist-y politics. And for a lot of people, that was kind of real and became a real part of their politics. I mean, I'm thinking of someone here like Ash Sarkar, who was a first year English student at UCL in 2010. I was a sabbatical officer at the time, and UCL was one of the biggest occupations in the country. So a couple of fair few people had formative experiences there. But if you look at her politics, very much libertarian communist, very consistent in lots of ways. But take a fair few other people who had libertarian communist politics, and really they kind of swing quite wildly around, I think. And so you have a generation that ends up, you know, some people end up in the Green Surge. You know, the Green Surge ends up capturing people into an electoral turn, and then you've got it coming out at the end in Corbynism. And I think the phenomenon of anarchism in the early 2010s is fascinating, and it's got a lot to do with various things. You know, this is the moment, probably the first great moment, where social media is playing a real role in social movements, both in Britain and across the world. There's a very kind of natural and quite fervent horizontalism, suspicion of institutions, because the institutions you can see around you are all crap, and also this kind of sense of leaderlessness. All of this intensely creative, hard to pin down sense of politics leaves all of these people doubly vulnerable to the trappings of Labourism. They don't really have a conception of what it is like to be a left winger in the Labour Party, because they reject that road out of hand. And so when they arrive in the Labour Party in 2015, they're kind of doubly vulnerable to. So you have this kind of flipping of the social movements, you know, from this massive social unrest with no political expression to this all of a sudden very, very just sort of orthodox Labourist politics. You cheer on the leader, you take orders from the leadership, and you go home and you wait instructions.
Brexit has happened, and many of the things we warned about are coming true, but no one seems to want to talk about it. Here at Another Europe, we say it's time for meaningful accountability and real scrutiny, and that's where our new project, Brexit Spotlight, comes in. We're breaking the silence and shining a light on the calamities. Find out more at brexitspotlight.org.
You know, at the very start of the book, you describe that kind of fire under Corbyn as deriving from the youth movements. And I really bolted it, I have to say, because I was watching from the other side of the coin. And I thought, I didn't know, there wasn't a single 80-year-old I knew who wasn't voting Corbyn in the leadership election. And that's, a lot of CLPs are absolutely peopled by that kind of Grey Panther vibe. You know, people who've been disappointed with Labour since 1997 and before. People who can still argue about whether John Smith was left-wing enough. So, but you know, ultimately, I came around to your point of view that Corbyn was kind of lifted more by that kind of Glastonbury energy than by the raw facts of how many CLPs swung him in. But do you think there was ever any kind of meaningful alliance between the old guard left and the new non-left left?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Corbyn moment was both young and old. And in fact, the missing generation was Generation X, but very, you know, you were. And I feel like this is the same as whenever I talk to my parents about how their generation is incredibly reactionary. And they say, well, we're not. And I'm, well, yeah, that's true. Of course, I mean no offence by this. I know so many Generation Xers are my friends. All of the conditions of possibility for Corbynism are defined by the outside. And it's that big anti-austerity movement that the student movement leads to that actually does that. Had there not been a big anti-austerity movement after the student movement, I don't think we would be living in the same universe. And I certainly don't think Jeremy Corbyn would have been Labour leader. And actually in that bigger anti-austerity movement, exactly the same phenomenon took place. It was young and old. So, yes, it was an alliance of young and old. And that alliance of young and old existed in the anti-austerity movement before Corbynism, before it existed in Corbynism.
And I'm going to ask both of you about Brexit, not about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but Michael, you kind of describe it very much as revealing weaknesses within Labour. Luke, what do you think those weaknesses were? And Luke, do you think the same?
I think it's interesting how generous you are to the other side of the debate. It's the other thing that makes it a good read. But maybe one thing that becomes somewhat overlooked, which I think is surprising to go back to the earlier story of the Milbank generation and how it impacts the decade, is that there is a kind of rise across the decade of something that I didn't expect, and it's not on our part of the left, but a kind of youthful Stalinism, a soft left nationalism, sometimes not so soft, a kind of new left nationalism. And it doesn't sit very well with the ideas, what John Moses in the book calls, drawing on Raymond Williams, you know, this structure of feeling that you describe in the early movement and you talked about earlier, that was very horizontal, but something else happens. And that side of the left was never a majority in any way. It was never a majority, I don't think, in Momentum. It was certainly never a majority in the Labour Party. It's been given much, much more energy by the Brexit process. And so your engagement with it tends to come through like talking to or about some of the older individuals, like Andrew Murray gets a mention in the Communist Party, but there is this sort of youthful, tanky politics that emerges alongside and through and given much more energy by the Brexit process as well. So I thought that was sort of quite interesting. And then it's also interesting that the book was not, there is, I hope you don't mind me saying, the Milbank discussion is a little bit nostalgic, and it contrasts very, very strongly with the Brexit discussion, which is not nostalgic at all. And so I think in that way, that's also quite revealing, given that both movements were defeated. One is capable of a nostalgic retelling, the student movement, the other isn't. And I would say it probably reveals, you know, at least two things about the Brexit process. First, for people on the left, including Michael, including us, it was always quite a mixed feelings movement, given the dominance of the old centre in the traditional and the mainstream campaigns and, you know, the Alistair Campbells and everything. And secondly, I think the stresses and strains of the process, no matter where you stood, left absolutely no one feeling happy about it. And I doubt even people that had dramatic successes in some ways, like I'm thinking here, Jolyon Warne or Gina Miller with their legal cases, or Another Europe and Michael with the Labour Motions campaign, no one was really left thinking that those successes gave them any reason to feel sort of nostalgic or look back on the experience positively. In a way, it was like the ultimate anti-nostalgia years. And the fact that its implementation since has been a complete disaster, I mean, simply reinforces that sense of frustration, this feeling that it was a waste of time and energy, a futile exercise in symbolic nationalism, with all the costs still being played out. So the fact that we were right about what would happen doesn't mean that you feel particularly good or positive, really, or certainly not nostalgic anyway, about the resistance that we put forward to it in the first place.
For me, the Brexit moment was full of kind of heartache and isolation, in a sense. You know, lost a lot of people in terms of political allies and so on. I also think that the Brexit moment was very much a winner-takes-all moment, in a sense. Like, I think if you're a centrist, maybe the mass movement element of it and all of those big marches and so on, maybe that would lead you to think that you'd kind of created this base of people who might be the base of something in the future. I think for those of us who are left remainers, we cohered a certain politics, that much is certain true, a kind of left internationalism, an open borders politics. But I think there wasn't some kind of great creation of human material in the same way as there was with the anti-austerity movement. The anti-austerity movement could fail, but you knew, we didn't know at the time, but you can look back and say, well, that created the conditions for Corbynism. That's one answer, I suppose. And the other, and what you raise, Luke, about Stalinism is absolutely definitely true. I think part of the rise is, oh God, it is really galling, isn't it? Of all of the kind of like political movements that doesn't deserve to be cool among the youth. I mean, really, is this your form of the form of nostalgic Leninism that's going to take root? I mean, like in the early half of the decade, we had the SWP, and they were awful, right? And I ended up being kicked around by them an awful lot, and we ended up in huge faction fights with the SWP. Their politics, I mean, is a golden beacon in comparison to some of the Stalinist stuff you get in and around the Labour left sometimes. But to pin all of this on Stalinism, though, would miss something. I think that actually an awful lot of what is going on when we look at the shutting down of internal democracy, when we think of machine politics, when we think of an intolerance for dissent and the domination of a kind of bureaucracies, actually we're kind of, and so it's kind of more what I see as Fabianism. And this is, I think to a great extent, we shouldn't compliment a lot of the stuff that happened around Corbynism, and I don't mean at all to characterise Corbynism as a whole like this, but the kind of Stalinist-y bits of Corbynism. I think we can call them Stalinist-y, but I think, or Stalinoid, or whatever you want to call them. Actually, I think that does proper Stalinists a disservice, because a lot of it wasn't really left-wing enough to be proper Stalinism. A lot of it was kind of pretty just bog-standard, middle-of-the-road, orthodox Labourism. The crucial differentiation point, I think, is less about Stalinism necessarily. It's about a politics from above and a politics from below. And I think that fundamentally, a lot of what Corbynism became, and some of this was necessary because it was about reasserting the right of social democrats to exist in mainstream politics. But a lot of what its more orthodox adherents became was about socialism from above, turning the taps of the state on for the grateful public.
So one of the points in the book that's obviously really quite controversial, especially in light of what you've just said, is this call for a new party. And in light of what you've just said, if the Labour left is so bad and so politics from above, why do you want them to split from the Labour Party so that you are stuck just with them and with no one else?
Yeah. I think unless you explain it, it sounds terrible, doesn't it? But let's do all that in a lift forever. The first thing, there's a lot of things to say. The first thing is, I don't think that the whole of the Labour left was like that, or is like that. A lot of the Labour left spent a long time fighting for internal democracy, specifically within the party. It didn't manage to achieve any internal democracy within the Labour Party in its time actually leading it. But actually, you know, at least in principle, they are into internal democracy, some of them. And I suppose the other big thing to say is that I absolutely don't think that we should split now. My case is very much not that people should leave the Labour Party. I'm still a Labour Party member. I plan to continue to be a Labour Party member. The thing that will enable us to move on from this is proportional representation, which will enable electoral alternatives to the Labour Party to exist in a real way. The Labour Party is the beneficiary of a tidal system. And it's a tidal system that draws people from social movements, from great moments of struggle, into the party, and digests them and makes them safe and knocks off their more kind of like radical and disruptive edges. And then eventually the tide goes out and there's another social movement turn, and then the tide comes in and there's another electoral turn. I think that if we were ever going to resolve or win in a real sense from that situation in which the Labour Party mediates all left of centre politics in the UK, Corbynism kind of would have done it. We're kind of in this nightmare, in this walking, waking nightmare.
It's funny how optimistic the book is compared to the formulation of the walking, waking nightmare.
If your political strategy is the strategy of the kind of just the Benite Labour left, I just can't fathom what it is that you think is going to change to make that start working. And I think a lot of the left is trapped in a kind of one more heave situation. I would love to be convinced that there is a plausible path to transformative change through the Labour Party.
I mean, aren't you guilty a bit of the one more heave thing in the new party account? That's what I'm wondering. And I think it reflects some of your pessimism regarding what's happened. I would say in a way that Corbynism has influenced the debate in the Labour Party thereafter about its economic strategy. It's in a completely different place to it was 10 years ago. Couldn't be more different, you know, public-owned energy company is still on the books and that kind of thing. And in a way, the anti-Brexit movement has, okay, it hasn't achieved anything that it set out to do. We have an extremely hard Brexit. However, it has laid the groundwork in part because, and I think this relates to the question of the Labour Party's move to the left, despite the fact that Starmer's clearly not a left-wing leader, because it sort of reflects ideas from social movements that are running with the stream of history. And so Brexit is going to fail, just like this government's economic strategy is failing in a dramatic way, and of course is in itself part of the Brexit process. And so I don't see a future where there's a left party that achieves transformational change on its own. I see a future where, yeah, if there is a left-wing party, it could probably achieve many of the transformational things that it set out to do, but probably not all of them, because that's politics. And if you had PR, there would be coalition negotiations, and it would end up in coalition, presumably, with the Labour Party and maybe with the Greens and others. So there will always be compromise and imperfection. Maybe my reading of what went wrong with Corbynism is a bit different, in the sense that, yes, of course, there was this, like, from above or from below split. But there was also, most importantly, I think, a failure of Corbyn to, on particular points, to run with the stream of history. I'm thinking here on foreign policy and his general lack of professionalism in how he ran his operation. And that combination of a kind of foreign policy that wasn't able to connect with any of the norms of statecraft would have been a disaster in the face of the Ukraine crisis. And his sort of lack of professionalism would have been a big problem sort of in general. So the one last heave thing that you rightly identify on the left as being, you know, this mentality, I mean, that would have been, you know, Corbyn becoming prime minister would have probably also, if he'd somehow managed to do it, if the Tories had collapsed prior to the 2019 general election and he ended up prime minister, probably would have also been, you know, quite a difficult situation for the left, in the sense that you would, if you were a betting person, you would have said defeat was more likely than victory, and definitely not a kind of sweeping total victory that maybe many people thought might have been possible after the 2017 general election.
I certainly don't think we'd have been in a position for kind of some sort of total victory. And I think, yeah, I mean, Corbyn was always going to fail. He looked plausible at one point that he might get into office and then do some good things and then fail. But, you know, yeah, you're right. It's politics. There's always imperfection and so on. And obviously a left party, the idea of having PR and a left party is not, or even multiple left parties, is not some kind of like new or radical thing, is it? I mean, it's the norm across most of Europe, and it's not like they're achieving transformational radical change all the time. But I think that it would be an imperfect world, but it would be a better imperfect world.
Okay, on that bombshell, I think we have to call that the podcast.
That concludes this episode of the Another Europe podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. There's no extra time on this pod. Usually members of Another Europe get access to an extended version as a benefit of membership. We'd still, of course, encourage you to join our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. To join us, go to anotheureupe.org/join. See you next time.